Hello, everyone, and welcome to JFG Tonight. Tonight, we are talking with a friend. Big Papa Fascist is here. Andrew, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. It's an honor to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, so you're an interesting guy, and I never really got to talk to you and understand you from your perspective, because when I went to your show, it's always either a debate or you interview me, and I thought we'd get some insight about the edge on which you live. Are you based or are you cringe? Let's resolve this situation tonight. Where are you? Where do you stand on the political spectrum?
So you would broadly consider me to be a paleo conservative. That would be the closest way to define my politics. As you probably know, I don't ascribe to the modern Groiper view of racialism, and that might be a distinguishment between me and Groipers as far as paleo conservatism goes. I believe heavily in Christian nationalism rather than ethno-nationalism, and that's probably the larger distinction. So it depends on who you asked if that's based, right? Some people say it's the most based, and some people say that it's the most cringe. It just depends on who you're asking at the time. So those are my politics. So how did I get started into those politics? My dad was a product of the late 30s. He was born. He was not a young man when he started his family. He was already in his 40s. So he had old time values, very, very old school values. And it was very common to talk politics with him even when I was 6, 7, 8 years old. So it's a totally different value structure. None of it applied at all to the 90s and to the early 2000s when I was going to school. None of it fit. And the times essentially got away from him. And the value structure remained for me, but the value structure seems to be behind in the times, in the modern times.
And you live in Michigan. It's a state that, if I'm correct, is progressively becoming cucked, becoming Canadian, becoming leftist. Is that correct?
No. And yes. So all the cities are gone everywhere. It doesn't matter where you are. If you're in a major metropolitan area, you're fucked. Okay. These are the worst places on planet Earth to live, especially during these. Can we talk about COVID on this channel?
Yeah, yeah. No? We're on Odyssey, okay. So it's a freedom of speech. Generally.
Okay.
Just don't do terrorism.
Sure, sure. Gotcha. No terrorism. So, yeah, especially post lockdown. So what's happened is inside the major metropolitan areas, Detroit, Grand Rapids, places like this, poverty's gotten worse. People have gotten worse. The supply chains here are fucked. As you might know, Michigan was one of the first places really hit with COVID. This was kind of ground zero for the entire virus in the United States. This was the first place that was massively affected. And the lockdowns kind of came here first. And so we got to taste it before the rest of the country. So we were feeding information out, you know, to my parents out west and to various friends that I have all over the nation, you know, and I'm like, man, bad shit's coming. It's no big deal. And here we are 2 years later and it's a nightmare. The rural Michigan, which is most of Michigan, is very, very conservative, very conservative. But the major metropolitan areas have such a massive population that they can literally just override the vote. And that's how we got that bitch Gretchen Whitmer in office, who is one of the worst fucking people who's ever existed on planet Earth. While her and her husband were out on their boat while everybody else was locked in their home. These people are nightmarish. So the major metropolitan areas are what cause the issue as far as voting goes. You'd be surprised. The state's actually, if you look at the state as a whole, it's red, red, red. And then it just has these two blue spots, you know, and they basically take over the whole state because that's where the population is.
Yeah. As a reminder to our crowd, you can send questions and super chats through Entropy. The link is right below the video. Entropy is my favorite platform for super chats. And our survey of the night, because we'll get to that subject soon. Do you miss blood sports? Yes, ma or no? And you can also send super chats through the Odyssey system. Just be signed in on Odyssey. So are you a product of public schools in America, or did you benefit from some kind of private education? Because it seems to me that your reincarnation of blood sports in the Crucible is kind of an intellectual peak in terms of respecting views, in terms of not allowing strawmanning and ad hominem. And so you look like a philosopher, but on the other end, you're dressed like a trucker. You look like a trucker from Michigan. And I'm like, where is this guy coming from?
So I have an interesting job. It's what you call a high IQ blue collar job. And oh, they're rare. So I'm a roboticist. But a lot of that is working with, heavy oils and grease and wrenches. And, you know, it's a very dirty job, especially since I'm in the food industry. But the flip side to that is you can't be a dumb fuck and do it. So, yes, I'm a product of public education. And from there, I went to a trade school, and then I apprenticed for many years to learn robotics. And I'm now a robotics engineer. So it's not a stupid man's path. You'd be surprised. It's actually a lot of the white collar folks who are the dumb ones, right? And you're always going, how did you end up in a position of authority over a cat, you fool, right? I tend to agree with you. I don't fit the general mold of what you'd see with, kind of a high profile blood sport debater, for sure.
So when you started the Crucible, when was this, and what was your motivating factors and your history? Were you aware of blood sports before?
No. So let me tell you the entire history. I have to go kind of way back here. So we've been at this roughly a little over a year and a half, I think. So I started with Brittany and Todd, and we had formed Politically Provoked. So what happened was that was a small Facebook group. You're talking, a couple hundred members. And the Facebook groups were constantly getting shut down, because if you say anything on Facebook that you're not supposed to say, it doesn't matter what it is, you're zapped. So I joined this group, and it was just a random group I had joined. I didn't know anything about it. This little talk show that they did it at night, and there was more people on the panel than people viewing the panel, type of thing, and I just happened to come across it while I was in that Facebook group, and it was like six liberals on there all smelling each other's farts and telling each other how great they were. So of course I said, why don't you send me a link, and I'll come in and have a little chat with you guys. So they sent me a link, and I went in and just fucking eviscerated all of them. Made them rage quit, made one of the gals kind of cry a little bit. It was bad. Well, Brittany and Todd happened to have, I think only Brittany was on that panel at that time. And then, their other guy who's there now, Justin, and she knew it was kind of electric when that happened. So she had invited me back. They did an in-depth interview with me, and a lot of people from that Facebook group wanted to go on this little tiny show and, have a debate with me. And so, I'm not the nicest person when it comes to progressives. I think that they're generally speaking absolutely the scum of the earth. I'm not particularly nice to them or kind to them when I'm in a debate with them. And it was electric TV. And when we started the YouTube, it was just kind of a little pet project. Nobody knew where it was going to go. And suddenly we were engaging with YouTubers who had these larger platforms. And a few months in, Destiny, Brittany had managed to kind of catfish Destiny, and I ended up in a debate with Destiny, and I've had a couple since then, I think. And from there, we just kept growing and growing and growing, and I ended up engaging with every single major large political figure throughout the Twitch and YouTube realm, really. Anybody who had anything to do with debates, I was on the other end at some point. Taking them on. And so the platform just started really growing exponentially. We had a falling out about 5 months ago, me and the other two members. And so what I wanted to do from the start was I wanted to have a debate platform that wasn't just blood sports, but it had a lot of integrity to it, where people felt they didn't, it didn't matter which side they were on. They felt like they were going to get treated well, treated with respect. And they felt like they could come back on and really share their views. And I also wanted morons to stay away. People couldn't follow the TOS, people who can't follow, you know, the programs. I don't want those people around because they just destroy your show. I learned that lesson when I started the Crucible. I started talking to gentlemen like you who started Bloodsports, who are like, look, if you have other people on who can't control themselves, it'll destroy your entire platform. So having a high integrity platform has been very important to me. And so, I mean, we learned everything that we possibly could about running high integrity debates, treating our guests well, making sure everybody had a good time. Sometimes the conversations are so highbrow that people, I don't think people can even follow them. And then sometimes they're just, you know, kind of basic blood sports. So it's quite the mix. It's not just Jerry Springer.
Yeah, it's interesting how Politically Provoked went another way, which is, you know, they have panels of 15 people, 13 of them, you wouldn't care about who they are. And it's kind of annoying. I mean, they've invited me to these things and I'm like, I'm not showing myself in a group of 15 people because there's no way a discussion between 15 people will be intelligent.
That's not what it's for. The point of those panels is not to have intelligent discussion. It's to have Ricky Lake discussion, right? Someone's throwing a chair, the Klan member's running over here, the black guy's tackling him, right? It's Jerry Springer, Ricky Lake. From my perspective, that was the path of least resistance. I saw it going that way, but panels to me are lazy anyway. They're a way for streamers to sit there and do nothing while their audience absorbs content from other people. But what I've noticed is that that's really the easy way. And I see most of these streamers with these shows start to go the easy way. They start to do the Dylan Burns thing. Let's have 15 people on, you know, and it gives you exponential growth. But what it doesn't do is, one, I don't think it makes you very much money. That's one. And then the second thing is I think that having the continuous shit show, I think that it kind of makes your platform a joke after a while. I think that people only tune in just like they did with Jerry Springer because they want to see a shit show, not because they want to actually learn anything or have a productive conversation. The other thing I think that sets a Crucible apart is that the moderators debate. And so debaters can challenge the moderators and we'll have them on and give them the same fair treatment that we give when we're moderating. And I think that that is another huge distinction. Having been on many leftist shows, they are not fair and they are not unbiased. They are fucking assholes. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that drove me crazy. So we knew we could be better than that. And we are better than that. JF has, you know, you yourself have come on multiple times, everything from, you know, a debate on race issues to with the right and the left to the God question to, you know, many of these different things. But the goal was always to make sure that the debaters had the best possible experience, felt like they were treated well. And if they lose, they don't feel like they lost because the moderation just wasn't there, you know. And that's another big problem with Politically Provoked that you never see on the Crucible is there is no moderation there. They just sit there while two people yell at each other, you know, and it's like, what are we doing here? We're not getting anywhere. So,
yeah, I found that they were kind of mindless because when you go on the Crucible, you'll have the host interrupt you on a specific definitional point and he will be like, okay, I just listened to your definition. I'd like you to clarify this. With the Politically Provoked, I don't even have the impression that the host is understanding what I'm saying. They're going to pass on what they get from the regular chat, maybe, but at best.
Well, they're not smart. Well, that's the other problem is that they're not smart enough to follow the very debates that they're hosting. I think in order to be a great host, you have to be a great debater yourself. Mm-hmm. I've said this many times. And I think the reason for that is you have to be smart enough to follow the debate. And sometimes one of the smartest things you can do in a debate is say, I don't understand what you just said. Can you break it down in a way that I can understand it? Because if I can't, the audience isn't either. And maybe we can get this on course, or sometimes your opponent isn't. Sometimes you're being straw-manned. Sometimes you're being ad hoc. You know, there's a lot of things, and people have their little custom debates that they like, right? So some people say, I want a shit show. That's all I want. I want to go in and yell at this guy. He wants to yell at me, and we're fine with that. But people who come in and say, look, we want to have an intelligent debate, and we want you to keep it on track, and we don't want a bunch of insults and this and that. We just want to get to the issues. I love those just as much.
So leftists are sometimes a problem with neutral platform because they don't realize that they have been cuddled in a world that doesn't examine their views, and they're hard to bring sometimes. Is it hard to get leftist on? I'm thinking, for example, of there was this guy I debated on your show, and then he spent a two-hour stream complaining about you not being fair to him.
The Euro Goblin. He was on the Euro Goblin stream. I remember. So that was when we first started, we did have trouble. You have to remember, too, I was inviting people on the show who I had crushed. You know, I had crushed them, or I had at various times made horrific fun of them, things like that. It took a while to build up the trust level that I could be a fair arbiter during a debate between a left winger and a right winger. But I've managed to earn the respect, I think, of both sides on the neutral platform. Now, you are correct. There are a lot of left-wingers who do attack the platform, but there's also, surprisingly, a lot of dissident right-wingers who are very upset with it. Now, for instance, I had Vosh on for an interview. When I had you on for an interview, it was very fair, and I wanted to get your side of everything. I wanted to hear everything you had to say. Same thing with Vosh. A lot of people DM'd me, and they, you know, why didn't you crush him on this? Why didn't you just rip his heart out when he said this? And, well, that's not what he was there for. He was there for us to get his politics out on the table. So when he comes back for a debate, the moderators know what his positions are, and we can understand and follow what's going on within his prism and his opponent's prism so that we can fairly moderate the debate. And it's like, but to some people, it's like, that's blasphemy. You know, you had Vosh on, and, you know, he rapes kids, and, you know, it's like, they go fucking ape shit that I didn't just throw them off the platform and this and that. And so I think it is a problem on both sides, to be honest with you, though. I do see it mostly from the LGBTQ left, who absolutely hates the fact that they know my personal stance on LGBTQ, but I still platform fairly LGBTQ people. I don't think they can reconcile that. That just, I think that blows their mind.
Yeah, they're engaged in kind of a war, and they want to totally exclude from regular communication anyone who disagrees with them, and yet they arrive at the world with this kind of novel view of sex is not binary, or gender doesn't exist, or that kind of crap, which dates basically from 5 years into the past and faces a tradition and a sexual reality that exists for millions of years in the human species.
Well, you know, it's funny you bring this up. I was just having a discussion about this morning. One of the things I've learned so much hosting so many of these debates on various platforms and engaging myself is that actually, if the right disengages, we're better off. We're just more inclined to engage. If the right doesn't engage, the left is, they eat themselves with intersectionality, like nothing I've ever seen in my life, ever. So you and I and Rob Knorr and Sean Last, we all had a debate and we all walked away friends. What's funny about it is the left can't do that. The intersectionality, if you say, for instance, I have a nuance on the trans issue, you're out, right? You're out forever. You're done. You're a bigot. You're a homophobe. You're this and that. And they really eat each other. And if you go to Twitch has run out every major right winger that there is, you know, with the exception of the Crucible. That's the only right wing platform that's left anywhere on Twitch. Mm-hmm. And what's funny about it is they started to eat themselves. So Destiny ran out of opponents. What does he do? He goes for the left. There's nobody else to go after. So intersectionality causes them to really just tear each other to pieces.
I see that there is Rachel Wilson on the regular chat saying, where is the best place to watch JFG now, D-Live or here? Here is the only place we are streaming. So there are some people complaining that there are hangups. Sorry, sometimes Odyssey has buffering issues, but Odyssey is still the platform where there's the most free speech, and so that's where I've decided to be. One thing you can help is if you undo your VPN. If you have lag issues, Odyssey reacts very poorly to VPNs, so unplug your VPN, and most people are getting the stream without bugs. So censorship, that's a big issue. How do you approach it at the Crucible? Given that you have been exploring edgy subjects, those are subjects where I've seen people being banned for exploring these subjects. Have you had any problem with strikes?
No problems with strikes. We've always been very cautious about who we bring on. We only want people on who understand that there is a TOS that has to be adhered to. That said, there's certain streams that I felt didn't actually cross the TOS line, but I was iffy about them. So I just got rid of them. My viewpoint is there's no content that's worth the channel, right? There's no content that's worth the channel. Doesn't matter if it's a debate with 150,000 people, it's not worth the channel that you spent all the time, energy, effort building up. I know that you've run into this yourself. Eventually the Crucible is going to get big enough and it's going to attract enough attention that it's going to inevitably likely be struck off of YouTube and struck off of Twitch at some point. My goal is just to hold that at bay for as long as I possibly can. I think it's an inevitability. And I also think that that'll happen not just to us, but to modern day debate. I think that that's going to happen to almost any platform that allows any kind of actual discourse. They're eventually all going to be removed. So what I always tell people is, look, just try to stay for as long as you can to build the largest audience you can to take with you, because you only get about 20% that transition with you. So, you know, you try to get it up to 50,000, 100,000, 120,000, try to transition to Odyssey for 30,000 so you can survive. Because, you know, otherwise it's very tough to do. I'm sure that you've had a lot of pains with your transition, right?
Well, not as much as I would have thought, because a year ago, what you say is true, 20% transition. But honestly, YouTube at this point hits your channel so hard when you're on there that most people will transition to Odyssey. Basically, my show makes the same viewership as it did on YouTube, but that's because YouTube was hitting on my show and they are shadow banning you and they're making you hard to find in the searches. So yeah. Right now, I would say expect the 80% transition if you move anything to Odyssey that's worth following.
Well, so Politically Provoked, they lost their YouTube channel shortly after the Twitter bans. When their Twitter was banned in the last ban strike, I knew that their YouTube was going to go shortly thereafter. It's been my experience that when one tech platform goes on a rampage, all the tech platforms go on a rampage, right? They come in pairs, they come in threes, right?
Yeah.
So it's going to be Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. Those three, if one of them's going crazy, they're all going crazy. And so I knew that that would happen. But when they transitioned over, though, I think they had a 7,500, 7,700 person channel. They were only able to transition with about 1,000. So they're basically at that 20 percentile marker. And the other problem I think that a lot of people have is monetization. So YouTube, it's actually not that difficult to make a decent amount of cash on YouTube, depending on who you are. So for some people, I think $400 or $500 a week is a lot of money. And, you know, for them, they're like, they could really make a living on that. You know, the single guy most certainly can, or a person without children most certainly can. For me, I don't consider that to be like a thing I could make a living on, but I think a lot of people could. And they have trouble when they transition. You know, they see their monetized value go way, way down. Odyssey is not so user-friendly with that either. I think maybe if Odyssey implemented things like those super stickers and, you know, the just kind of neat stuff like that, the bells and whistles, that it would be helpful. But
Yeah, I guess they will get there. Let's get your thoughts on some news item to explore the broadness of your political positions, because there are some things I really don't know about you. Even things basic like the masks, the lockdowns. Today, we are following the trucker blockade of a passage between the U.S. and Canada, the border. Right now, the federal...
It's full of Nazi flags! Full of Nazis and Confederate flags! And they're gonna kill Justin Trudeau! It's insane! Right? This is this is the media narrative. Yeah, I've been watching this this very carefully. So I don't think, in the end, that this is going to end up going anywhere. The media assault that's on it is insane. But I think that it's a great symbol. What it reminds me of is back in the day, there was, I don't know if you ever heard of an organization called Border Angels. Well, what they were was an organization that were leaving water and food and maps and flashlights in the desert so that illegal immigrants could obtain these items and make their passage illegally into the United States far easier. A massive response that was formed to that was called the Minutemen Project. And all they did was stand on the border with binoculars and report illegals to the proper authorities. And of course, they got all the media hatred and this and that. But it created a symbol for people to look at, you know, something for them to look at, for them to say, look, not everybody's terrified. Not everybody's scared. Not everybody's shaking in their boots. Canada is a year away from the day of the rope. I mean, the people in Canada are 10 times more pissed off than people in the United States are about what's going on. And
which
I think
is weird
that
historically, because it's never been that case. Americans have always been the great defenders of freedom.
Yeah, but I think Trudeau is what did it. You know, Trudeau is a weak, weak cuck of a man. He's by far, just listening to Trudeau will make your balls shrink. That's how terrible this guy is. And Canadians, I think, at an intuitive level, hate his fucking guts. Almost every male in Canada that I've talked to over Discord and, you know, the hundreds of different people who come through, the Raging Dissident would be another one who is a big defender of freedom inside of Canada. I think that Trudeau was the tipping point. His ineffective leadership through the COVID lockdowns, like we at least had Donald Trump. We had a strong man we could look to.
Donald Trump bent the knee to the experts class. That's very disappointing.
You're right. He did. But what I'm saying is that Donald Trump was at least perceived as a strong leader. Trudeau is perceived as a panty waist little, you know, little priss. And I think that he's the tipping point. But yeah, the Canadians are furious. They're pissed. I've heard thousands of them now talking about the day of the rope. It's moving through like wildfire. I'm glad to see these truckers doing this. But I think that I don't know that they're going to survive the media assault. And it's just not going to all break up like so many of these movements tend to do. I hope it doesn't, but I got a feeling it will.
Yeah, I think the same. It's very hard to face this kind of the mob, the normie mob. It's undefeatable. There's too many of them. You mentioned men. It's very easy for men to have an instinctual hate of Trudeau, but women, it's a different story. And one of the problems is that women are a very powerful demographic, more than 50% of the people alive, and that leads to a lot of women vote.
It actually leads to a lot of female power. I mean, they have all the buying power. They have, most of the cash, most of the capital. They're doing better in almost every industry, including education, because they basically own it. Most of the medical industry is filled with women. Men are second-class citizens, to be perfectly honest with you. And biologically, in a way, we kind of take that protector role. And we like to indulge women, right? We like to, you know, when they're being a sassy bitch, even, you know, we'd be like, oh, you're cute. Here's some flowers. You know, there's a lot of indulgence from men. And I think a lot of men are beginning to wake up. They went to this extreme MGTOW, which was stupid. But I think that there's an in-between you can get to where you don't take shit from women, but you also don't hate them. Generally speaking, politics has always been a man's arena. It's only the West, and it's only in the last 100 years that women have been allowed to participate. It's been a fucking disaster. And we should get as that one of the things that women will not miss if they no longer have it is the vote, because they never wanted it in the first place.
They never wanted the vote, you say?
No, they never wanted it in the first place.
What does that mean?
Well, so the vote during the suffrage years, the suffragettes, you know, there was a lot of men, powerful men who were behind the lobby. But most women, they didn't give a flying fuck about voting. They thought it was a responsibility and a burden. And they're like, why just let men do it? Who cares about it? It wasn't inside their purview or inside of their arena. They still had an egalitarian society because that was the domain of men. They just didn't get involved in the domain of men. Men were the ones who tipped that vote, not women. Women did not want overwhelmingly.
But now they've been propagandized to want that vote and to cherish it. I hear that your wife is writing a book on these subjects.
It's published. You can pick it up right now on Amazon. It's called Occult Feminism, and it's the secret history of feminism. And much of this is discussed with the suffragettes, things like this. I suggest that everybody pick up a copy. She also just had a knockout. It was one of the largest articles on Gab ever in their history. If you go to Gab News, it's right on the front page. It's on homeschooling. She's just really knocking it out of the park with her writing and understanding that the feminist bloc is one of the biggest purveying threats to the West. And it has been you can actually watch as women get more rights, society degradate, and it's almost in unison with it. You know what I mean? It's almost in unison with each other. And I don't say repeal the 19th. My solution is always to say that we should never have had a democracy to begin with. We should have had limited democracy where stakeholders were allowed to vote. And that's it. You shouldn't have low IQ fucking idiots who can cancel out my vote. They don't even understand the issues. That's how Canadians ended up with Justin Trudeau, because he's so handsome, right? He's so handsome. And
well, that's a case of gerontocracy, I would argue, because you go in Montreal, you go into these extremely aging population, 70-year-old, 80-year-old. All they need is a relatively feminized guy that is overly authoritarian, but also overly insecure and wanting to please, and they like it. It's all cute. It looks good for them.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're right. For women, optics is very important. But if you spent your entire life and the biggest weapon that you had at your disposal was your sexuality, I'm sure that optics would be important to you too. You know, but that is the ultimate weapon of women, is their sexuality and their sensuality. And I feel like they gave up the best weapon that they had in order to act like men, which is insane, because men will give them whatever the hell they want just based on their ultimate weapon, which is sexuality. So to me, it's all counterintuitive. And it should never have been done to begin with. Men, generally speaking, love women. We have sisters, we have moms, we have, you know what I mean? This type of thing. We're not brought up to hate women. This is a purely leftist narrative. We're brought up to cooperate with them and to lead our families, but that doesn't mean you're at home slapping your wife around. It's just ridiculous. This is all leftist tripe.
I don't hate women, but I hate the game they're playing. That's the way I see it, because they are playing a totally different game with everything, including their relationship with reality. I mean, they are in a social world. You can see that they construct stuff in their head, and it's about social perception, whereas men are first and foremost connected to the universe and then the social world.
Well, it's true. Yeah, and you bring up a good point, right? You can't have a patriarchy without patriarchs. And I've often said, if men tomorrow decided women have no rights, they don't have rights. And if women wake up tomorrow and decide men have no rights, we can say, shut up, bitch. Yes, we do. Right? So the thing is, really, JF, whose fault is it?
Well, right? Whose fault is it? And the solution to all this, Christianity? A kind of Christian conception of society?
Yeah. So Christianity, I think, would give you most of what you wanted. Even if you just followed the ethical framework rather than the God framework. I don't think there's anything in the ethical framework of Christianity that even atheists dislike. So this is what I propose, is not that we have a theocratic state, but when I say that everybody wants to go back, this is what Trump said. Trump would always say, people want to go back. And they'd say, when? To segregation? You want to go back to when everyone was mean to women? You want to? No, that wasn't what he was saying. And he didn't know how to articulate it right. But what he was really saying is, we want to go back to a values society, right? And what gave the West its values? I don't think that JF would disagree that that was Christianity. Christianity is what produced the values that we all hold so near and dear. And so I advocate only for the value system. If you promote the value system is inarguable. Utilitarians can't argue against it. Muslims can't argue against it, as they share much of it. Jews can't even argue against it without looking stupid. So the point of it is to promote a value structure that we can all adhere to, because we don't have it right now. Right now, it's do as thou wilt, every man for himself, unlimited porn, unlimited sex, unlimited whatever you want. And anytime you talk about people, or anytime people talk about wanting to expand freedom, I want to expand freedom. They don't. They want to expand degeneracy. If you put a person to a question and you say to them, what freedom do you want to expand? They never say speech. They never say guns, right? They always want to limit guns. They always want to limit speech. They always want to limit these things. They want an unlimited right to fuck each other in the ass. That's what they want. An unlimited right to fuck each other in the ass. The unlimited right to have same-sex marriage. The unlimited right to have abortions. The unlimited right to do sin. They never seem to want to expand the rights of things that require responsibility, like speech, like guns, many of your other intrinsic, what I would consider God-given rights. They don't ever want to expand those. They only want to expand sin. This is my interpretation.
I like the split that you do between the ethics part of Christianity and the God part, because in a way, there is two failures in America. The one failure of atheism is to try to eliminate so much the God part that in doing so, you eliminate the whole thing. You throw the baby right with the bathwater, you get rid of religion, and you get rid of all the useful moral programming that this has been stacking over thousands of years. On the other hand, there are preachers who are so obsessed about the God announcement and Jesus comes to save you and you need to accept Jesus in your heart, that they are losing a little bit of the moral programming that's in the Bible and the traditional conceptions of the family and of all sorts of ethical programs that they're not mentioning, and they become open, for example, to LGBTs and other kind of non-reproductive behavior. So you strike a very important balance there. You're kind of at the middle of the road between Richard Dawkins and those kind of pro-LGBT leftist pastors in America.
LGBTQ is the greatest threat to the Western nation. It's far greater than people even imagine. And I'll tell you exactly why. The transgender movement has completely and totally eradicated reality. They've eradicated it. It doesn't exist. They can say that they're a rock. And if you don't agree that they're a rock, in some countries now and in some places now, including your own nation, there can be significant penalties to you because you don't believe that they're a pretty fucking unicorn. Right? You're a pretty unicorn. This is the assault on the fabric of reality itself. So would I love it if everybody was a Christian? Sure. Is that completely unrealistic? Of course it is. But what's not unrealistic is that you can share the same Christian moral framework that I do without having to beat you over the head with a Bible. We can at least get to some semblance where we have a reality we can agree on. Right now, we don't even agree on what's reality. I've had people tell me that they're men when they clearly have a vagina. I've had men tell me that they're women when they clearly are not women. The only thing that they consider the distinction is self-identification. And for me, this in and of itself, just if you self-identify, you become that thing, is an assault on reality itself. And yet I see so many people following into the programming. And this is why I think that this metaverse is going to be so successful. Because if you can convince yourself that you're a woman, when you have an Adam's apple and a penis, what can't you convince yourself of, JF?
That's true. I never thought about it. But in the metaverse, there's no difference between a trans woman and a woman.
Right. Right. There's not, right? It's all VR. It's a simulation in a simulation in a simulation, right? It's absolute insanity. And this is why I think that the LGBTQ threat is the greatest threat. Without the original homosexual lobby, transgenderism wouldn't be where it is today. They piggybacked off of it, and it never made any sense because many of them are not homosexuals. So why are they included in a homosexual movement? They just hijacked the lobby. The lobby had the massive infrastructure that was there, and they never stop. So you don't go, oh, we have equal rights now, we're just going to stop. They never fucking stop. They get the equal rights, and then they have to find more and more nuance to go after for more equality until you get to the point of absurdity where people say, I'm actually an Asian man, right?
Well, that's exactly where I wanted to be headed. So this, let's not be deceived, however, and let's not put our guards down and think that because some of the traditional proper ethics of past humans and of our ancestors were expressing themselves through religion, that religion itself applied to a completely foreign population could be a solution at all places. Do you really think that if I take Christianity and I drop it over the head of in the middle of Africa, in some nation in the middle of Africa, that I will fix the society there? Or do you think that there is something missing, that the moral program isn't contained in the Bible, but it's contained in the genes of the people who carried the Bible?
Well, let's use your evolutionary framework. One of the big arguments E. Michael Jones makes, which I tend to agree with, is that the West had about 1,500 years of Christianity on its side. It took a while for them to go through the processes of developing this large, complex moral system. If you drop it on Native Americans, let's say, they did not respond to it very well because they did not evolve into it. It's a progression. It's not something that's instantaneous. It takes many generations to indoctrinate them into such a moral system. Right now, only the West has it. The nice thing is that the United States, well, it's not the nice thing, but the demographic replacement that's going on in the United States is mostly from Latin America. Okay, almost exclusively, in fact. It's very little in any other demographic, though I think that that's going to change in the coming years. Right now, this is the fact. And the Latin American nations are heavily Catholic. Integrating Hispanics by the third generation, you can't tell the difference. There's very, very little difference between what maybe an ethno-nationalist would consider an Anglo and a Hispanic. They don't look that different. Like, even take Nick Fuentes, for instance. If he didn't tell you that he had, you know, a Hispanic bloodline, I wouldn't know it just to look at the guy. You know what I mean? I don't know about your contentious history. I'm just saying.
Leaving aside the contentious history, the problem is, if Nick Fuentes has 10 babies, will these 10 babies be on average more Democrat, more anti-free speech, more anti-gun rights, even if they're Catholic or even if they're Christian of some kind? And the answer is yes, they will, more than white people.
It's true, but only till that third generation. And then they seem to be indistinguishable. Same thing happens from Cubans. The Cubans come over, they seem to vote much more heavily Republican than we thought. And this is because they had a life under communism. They don't like it, right?
Well, you make a survey right now in America of the Hispanic population, whether they are for free speech or against. And you realize they are much less for free speech than the white population. I think there might be something irreplaceable in the white population's kind of instinct for freedom, precisely because they were not attracted to America because there was some race living there that had made the country great. They were attracted to America because it was an empty place in which they could build the world of freedom that we today are looking for and want. This is a different story, the immigration of Europeans toward America, than the story of Hispanics saying, oh, more money, let's go north.
Well, sure, but Hispanics are 50% European. They're mestizos. 95% of the country is 50% European.
And that's so, not full. And I mean, it's a very different genetic nuclei from the white Americans that have been there for hundreds of years.
No, well, sure. But I'm just saying it's like, so if you're 50%, if you're a mestizo, you're 50% European, and you come and you breed with a white chick, and then the next generation you breed with another white chick, at what point does it become indistinguishable, the blending?
But this is not happening, BPF. You're not, they're breeding among themselves at 85%. So it's just not happening.
Well, no, I mean, I tend to agree. I want a moratorium on immigration. I'm not saying that all cultures are compatible, because they're not. I don't think that the West is necessarily incompatible, or that the United States is incompatible with Mexican culture. There's not huge differences, to be perfectly honest with you.
But you wouldn't, you wouldn't go live in Mexico.
I think I would. The cost of living is pretty cheap.
Why don't you go?
I think maybe we will get at least a summer house in Mexico.
Yes, yeah, summer house, exactly. To benefit from the weather, but never for the society.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the society has corruption issues. Exactly. But I think a lot of those corruption issues come from this Enlightenment document that they based their constitution on after the Mexican Revolution. And this was the same Enlightenment document that we had after our revolution. And I think that Enlightenment document has not done us so well. It allowed for all of these different types of amendments to go through a democratic process, which has created this nightmare of the female voter. It's created multiple nightmares across the board for us to deal with, constitutional crisis after constitutional crisis. And, you know, Mexico's had about 100 years with this document. Their government's corrupt as shit. We have been dealing our CIA with their cartels. It's a madhouse. I'm just saying, from my perspective, Mexican culture itself is not so different from American culture. There's not, other than the language, it's a fairly Catholic culture. You don't feel particularly out of place when you're in Mexico, I don't think. I think that the culture shock, if you went to Africa, in other words, would be much greater. You know what I mean?
It would be great.
Yeah. It would be much, much greater. So I don't know that we have a huge problem with integrating Hispanics, but you can't integrate any peoples when you're bringing in 1 million a year. That's insane. If you're going to have an immigration policy because you can't keep your own birth rates up, and that's a problem that we're having. And so you want to replace the loss in children with immigrants, then you had better have some type of program for assimilation. And we don't have anything like that. We just willy-nilly here to bring in 1 million and you can do whatever the fuck you want. And here's social welfare and here's social programs and here's whatever the fuck you want. And it's a nightmare. Now, would anybody really have a problem if you brought in, let's say, 55,000 immigrants a year and they went through a cultural program for 2 or 3 years or something like this, so that they were completely integrated? One of the criteria is they couldn't take anything off the public trough, or they had to have skills, et cetera, et cetera. Who would be upset by that? Like, I don't think I would be that mad about that. That wouldn't upset me.
All right. Go away sends a super chat. He says we have much higher government corruption in Australia compared to NZ due to, well, I will not read the rest of the super chat, but thank you for the support. Stephen J. James says, base JF. All right. Thank you for your super chat. Now, geopolitics and war. We have learned today that there was a strike there was an attack in Syria where the US government went in and killed some guy who's been planning ISIS terrorism, according to them. And they said, oh, yeah, by the way, this was a building in which some children may have been killed. But that's not us. It's because the guy that we wanted to kill has blown himself off. And this resulted in the death of a child, as it often does. I mean, it's amazing the number of American strikes that results in the death of children. And it's never our fault. What's your take on these old Middle Eastern meddlings of America?
So this goes back to the Clinton era. Clinton was famous for wagging the dog. And I don't know if you ever saw the movie, Wag the Dog, but I think that whoever created that movie in Hollywood probably got assassinated shortly after it was created, because it really gave you a good roadmap for how this works. As far as geopolitics goes, America has no enemies. They really don't have any enemies except the ones that we choose to have. Nobody can fuck with us. It's absolutely impossible. We have an ocean between us and them with the most powerful navy that's ever existed in the history of all of mankind. It's impossible to do anything to us unless we allow you to do it, period. So anything that you see as far as a foreign action, there's something that we want or somebody who pissed us off. Every single time. And usually it's they didn't play ball, they didn't bribe the right person, or they're not in some type of pedophilic social elite club.
All right. So I fully agree with this assessment. Today there was an antibody study showing that natural immunity to COVID is resilient 2 years after having it. The antibodies are still present, so acquiring an actual infection of COVID as
is better than the vaccine.
Yeah, well, I mean, they wouldn't say better than the vaccine in this story, but certainly it leaves the possibility, given that the vaccine antibodies were enough after 3 to 6 months, depending on the vaccine. Do you look at the whole COVID thing as being bullshit, as being an overtake of the technocratic state with lies, with the purpose of controlling the social world or imposing some controls over business?
So I'm going to be completely honest with you. When COVID-19 first hit, I was an advocate that we should probably follow some type of program for social distancing and this type of thing. And I'll tell you why. It seems every 100 years, a massive plague actually does hit humanity, and it does kill a lot of people, going back to the 1918 flu before that, going all the way back to the Black Plague. These things actually do happen. And I think that that was the linchpin that kind of got them in. I think a lot of people have that same thought process. You know, it's time for such a plague to actually hit. And so we kind of allowed, we were the architects of our own demise in this. And I even to some degree, I participated in that, to my everlasting shame. But I thought, you know, it was the 100-year, it's the 100-year mark, you know. I'm sure that these bat-eating Chinese heathens probably absolutely, you know, got infected with some type of crazy-ass plague. It wouldn't surprise me a bit. Having talked to musicians from China multiple times, especially from the Wuhan province, they say it's the most disgusting fucking area you could ever imagine. It certainly wouldn't have surprised them that a plague came from there. But now, in retrospect, looking at it 2 years down the road, the libertarians had a point, didn't they? Right? The libertarians had a point. COVID-19 at this point is not something anybody needs to worry about. No, it's nothing anybody needs to worry about. I've had it twice. I had the original strain. That was about 3.5 weeks. It sucked. I've had Omicron. That was 1.5 weeks, and I've been way sicker. I don't know anybody who's died from Omicron. I only knew 2 people who died from COVID-19, and they were both morbidly obese. So I don't think that this is a threat anymore. I don't think it's been a threat for a long time. It's absolutely a play. We've seen the massive redistribution of wealth between small business to large corporate entities and oligarchs like Walmart, Amazon, different places like this, which were allowed to operate while small business was completely and totally shut down. The Trump promise, I think he tried to buffer that by giving them these loans that they didn't have to pay back. But then, of course, they found out later they would have to pay them back and this type of thing. And honestly, we need to stop all of it. No more masks. We need to, if everybody went out tomorrow and acted like everything was normal, it would be. He would not be able to ascertain that there was a problem.
What do you retain from the Trump presidency? Are you black-pilled that having our guy at the top of the U.S. didn't even work? He eventually got cucked like the others. Does that black-pill you, or does that just tell you Trump wasn't the right guy?
No, I don't even think he was necessarily the wrong guy. I think out of all the people to look to for wisdom on this, I can't believe I'm saying this, but Michael Moore, the big fat fuck Michael Moore, had the best take on this of anybody ever. He said Trump was a fucking hand grenade for the working class. And we pulled the pin and we threw it in because we wanted to create as much carnage as we could. And that's exactly what we did. We pulled the pin, we threw it in, and he created maximum carnage, much to our amusement. And we would say all kinds of things like God Emperor Trump, Lord Trump, may he live forever, things. And they were all tongue in cheek, but they were designed specifically for us to say, no more of you oligarchs, go fuck yourself. No more of this bullshit, go fuck yourself. We'd rather have a bumbling fool in there who makes us laugh than have another cheap, empty suit who enacts policies that are only designed to strip the middle class of their wealth and redistribute it upwards. And that's what's always happened. And the upper class keeps the middle class wealth. A tiny bit of it gets trickled down through welfare programs to the lower class, but not very much. It's always been about the elimination of the middle class. That's part of the communist takeover. It's always been that way. You can't have a communist takeover based on class if everybody's doing well, right? Can't be done. But you've seen communists, their primary plan always is to erode the middle class. And that's exactly what happened. Trump brought a lot of that back. He did bring back economic prosperity, but that wasn't due to any specific policy. It was just that people had faith again that maybe there was somebody who was the ultimate outsider. You know, maybe there was somebody there who wasn't corruptible. Maybe there was one person left that we could turn to. And that he had the weight of the world on his shoulders. I'm not surprised that he buckled.
Absolutely. I think Trump was kind of a drive of self-deception by the American people, saying we're going to self-deceive ourselves into greatness. The same way a car salesman convinces himself that his car
is worth. What a great take. It's so true. I mean, that is so true. It's exactly true.
I've been saying this in 2016. Now, today, saying this doesn't give me much credit, but to have seen that and what was happening then as what it was, which is we're going to take a car salesman and we're going to put it at the head of America. That's how a lot of boomers approached him. For people like me who are more kind of anarchist of the internet, he was a hand grenade, the way Michael Moore describes. But right. For boomers, he was mostly a car salesman and a brander. Hyde Security, so we have Brendan now. Let's go, Brendan. But he was a brander and a marketer, Trump. Hyde Security sends a super chat. He says, Adam Green from No More News has been making some compelling arguments about the history and origins of Christianity. Is Andrew aware of his work, and does he have any comment or desire to bring him on to debate?
Absolutely. I talked to Ethan Ralph and requested that Ethan Ralph set that debate up. If that doesn't happen through the kill stream, I'll set it up on the Crucible myself. I'm happy to take on Mr. Green on his views. I have no problem. Just so that JF's audience knows, I know JF knows this, I don't run from fights. I never have, and I'm never going to ever. I've always felt if I lost a debate that it made me more skilled at debate from having lost it. The good news is I haven't lost that many. The bad news is that the ones that I have lost, they were really painful and I learned a lot.
Oh yeah. Right? What are the debates you lost?
Well, there was two bad ones. One I lost with Mouthy Infidel on homosexuality, and it helped me refine every argument that I had. I wouldn't lose that debate a second time. And then with Destiny, my first debate, I lost, but the second debate, I won. So again, you learn through losing, you know what I mean? And I was new to the scene. I hadn't taken on the high profile guys, but at this point, I'm happy to throw my hat in the arena with almost anybody on my views. I think most of them are fairly unassailable.
Marty and Fidel, homosexuality debate. What was the structure of the debate and what was your position?
The structure, so at that point, Mouth the Infidel, I think, was the first actual serious debater who had a reputation I had come up against. At that point, I had mostly just made fun of homosexuals for being homosexuals because I thought it was funny. Right. And anyway, my position on it was that I think I said something along the lines of the government should promote, you know, moral values instead of this. His response was, well, we can do both. We can promote moral values and have homosexuality. And can you name the thing about homosexuality that's actually immoral? You know, there was a whole line of logic that he had laid out. He'd obviously had the debate many times, and I just was not, I think, as prepared as I could have been. I didn't do terrible in it. Don't get me wrong. It's just that I know when I lose, and it makes me angry, and it makes me want to not lose next time, right?
To me, when I talk about homosexuality, I like to bring attention to the non-reproductive nature of it. And ultimately, non-reproductive means unsustainable across generations. There is a problem in the current world where the state propagandizes non-reproductive lifestyle, LGBT, homosexuality, and it catches certain parents who are just at the border of survival. They can afford only getting one, two children, or at least they think that's all they can afford, and they end up having their only reproductive representative of, in the next generation, convinced by the state not to have their own children. That's a big problem, and it's ultimately a it's a debt that the homosexual community lives with. A debt. They exist because of heterosexual sex, but they don't provide existence to other beings in the future because of their sexual choice.
What about adoption, though, JF? What about adoption?
Well, think about it. Well, here's how you address this. And this is funny because you're playing the homosexual's advocate here. That is one big realization of me today. I got you to side with the gays. I think this will make internet history. Yeah, but adoption doesn't work because if you care for the genes of some other couple, you are still eliminating the genes of your parents from existence. So the system is not sustainable. It's like you're going to do that. This is cuckery, essentially. You're going to do that as long as there will be children that will be fed to the homosexual family until there is no more homosexual family because there is not enough reproduction in this part of humanity.
So my argument now is a little more nuanced. I like that one. Don't get me wrong. My position on this is, where do homosexuals come from? Because it's not hereditary. And yet, if you live with one, you're more likely to be one. So where do they come from exactly?
Well, they come from heterosexual sex.
Right. Well, but I mean, it's not like a hereditary thing. So if dad was gay and, you know, he dies or whatever, and you're raised by, you know, a different dad and mom, let's say, you're not any more likely to be gay than your neighbor is. So, but if you live with homosexual parents, like you have a lesbian mother, for instance, or you have a gay father, you're far more likely, based on that environment, to become gay. You see this even in adoption. So my question is, where do they come from? And if it's not hereditary, it must be a learned behavior. And why are we teaching people a behavior, like you say, that's non-reproductive? It makes absolutely no sense. I also don't understand the you can't help who you're attracted to. That is a stupid argument because you absolutely can help who you're attracted to. I don't know who the fuck came up with that.
Yeah, that is one of the... I mean, I've been reading a lot about this because today I was writing an article for our encyclopedia of arguments of right-wing positions. We're making an encyclopedia called arguably.io. And I'm precisely writing an article on this claim that you are born gay. And it's central to the gay agenda, I believe, because I think there is something like a bias in human psychology that if you're born with it, you shouldn't be discriminated against it. And that's how the leftists, who are so much against discrimination, can justify anti-vax, like unvaccinated discrimination.
Yeah. It's not immutable.
It's your choice.
It's not an immutable characteristic. It's not an immutable characteristic, right? And you're right. The whole thing does revolve around the fact that they need it to be something that's inert that you can't help. And so then it becomes unassailable. The truth is that you can stop being a homosexual tomorrow. All you have to do is not have gay sex. Who would ever know? Nobody, right? No, nobody would ever know. So the thing is it's not just that, but the same thing with pedophiles. Pedophiles will say now, the MAPS will say, hey, you know, I can't help who I'm attracted to. Why is it that you're mad at me for having thoughts? Well, is it okay for me to have racist thoughts? Well, no. Well, okay. So, you know, that's the thing, but not just that. There is a cure for pedophilia. It's called chemical castration. It's worked for 200 years. It is scientifically the most effective way to treat pedophiles. And they say, well, we want them to come forward and let us know they're pedophiles so we can treat them. I go, well, do they advocate for the most effective treatment? Of course not, right? Why would you, if you say that you would do anything in the planet to not be a monster, not advocate that you be chemically castrated if you're a pedophile? You're lying, right?
That is a very good capture. When you test the leftists on this, it's like, did I choose to be a racist? That is a point of conflict within the leftist mind. I've seen a meme about this that was doing it with the vaccination status. It was saying, don't discriminate against me because I'm unvaxxed. I'm born this way.
It's an immutable characteristic. I couldn't help it, right? I couldn't help it. So, I mean, I think you're right. And I think that it does make your position a little more unassailable if it is something immutable. I think we can agree to that to some terms. Like, if I wouldn't want to see someone get treated like shit because they were born with a humpback, for instance, right? That's something that they couldn't help. I think that we can all understand that to a degree. I just think they take it to the, you know, the overload level of like, what the fuck are you doing, man? You know, you take it to this absurd level where now everything is inborn. You know, I can't help that I'm transgender. I was born this way. There's no evidence anywhere scientifically that you can find that you're born to be the opposite gender. They say, well, what about brain scans? There's like six people that happened to. And how do you scan a brain for gender? Right.
Well, here's the thing they will say, although I don't agree with them, but they will say, yes, there are some genes that are associated with becoming gay. Eventually, we could maybe find some genes that are associated with becoming trans. To that, what I say is, it's not because it's a gene that it's not responsive to what happened in your life. There could be genes that make you respond in a certain way to events happening in your life. And so a gene isn't set to be if a gene causes something, it doesn't mean that it's not cultural or not learned. It's genes, after all, that create the parts of our brain that can learn from the environment.
You're talking about like predilection. So you could have more of a predilection to be an alcoholic if you have whatever genes make you more prone to be one if you drink. And so that would be an environmental cause, right?
Yeah.
So you could have a gene that would make you more likely to be gay if you had the learned behavior of being gay, in other words.
Yeah. Now, in Canada, it's becoming very hot because they're about to make illegal the conception that you can do conversion therapy.
Yeah.
And it's about to become illegal to even publicize conversion therapy. Which is bizarre because they've been doing conversion therapy toward the gay lifestyle for many decades now.
Have you seen the video of the person, the president of the American Psychological Association? I believe that this was in the 70s, that he was the person who really pushed over that homosexuality is no longer a mental illness. And one of the things that he states is, look, we fucked this whole thing up because conversion therapy was never really looked into. We don't have anything to draw a parallel with. And by the way, psychology is completely infested with women and homosexuals. So it's a very biased practice. Now, this is him saying that, not me. This is the former president of the APA. And he's on video saying, look, there's no diversity in psychology. Right. It's like 70% women and homosexuals. There's very few what you would call heterosexual straight white men, right? There's almost none.
It's hard to conceive the extent, but like I've been giving exams because I was an academic back in my days. And so I was giving exams to classes of psychology. Imagine a crowd of 300 people and you might have one guy. That's 299 right. girls sometime for a single guy that you would see in the crowd. So it's just that much. So when you imagine the long-term consequences of doing this, and it's been increasingly, they've been doing this to even medicine. I don't know what medicine will look like in 20 years from now, but it seems like it's headed for a big mess.
And is it any coincidence then that the replication crisis affects two fields more than any other, which is medicine and psychology, right? These are the two fields that are most affected by the replication crisis, of fields that are completely and totally dominated by women who don't use the logical part of their brain. They want to know how you tick. How do you tick? How do you tick? You know, how does that brain work? And it's like, look, psychology to me is a pseudoscience. It's a pseudoscientific pursuit. I don't consider it a hard science. I don't consider it tangible. And I think that inbuilt in all of us is the ability to psychoanalyze each other to some degree. Otherwise, we couldn't get along in the world. And I think that women have perverted this into things, you know, they make these predictive models that are so fucking stupid. You know, men prefer this because of this. It's like, just shut up. They don't. You're wrong. You don't know what you're talking about. You know,
and there was a place for a good psychology. It could have existed. I'm fascinated by human behavior, but that's the problem. There's a difference between human behavior and making a true quantification of it, and then having your little structural theories about the mind and how jealousy motivates this, and then the inner desire to dominate. And it's all psychology lives in the head of a woman. That's the problem.
It does. It does. And you know what else lives there? Conjecture. It's a lot of conjecture, you know, like a lot of, you know, like how many times do you see these dumb e-thoughts, right? Try to psychoanalyze people live. Like they all try to psychoanalyze everybody, right? They're always like, he has traditional narcissistic tendencies. Hey, shut up, bitch. You don't know what a narcissistic tendency, they hear this shit. They regurgitate it. They don't even know what it means. And I think 90% of the time, the psychologists who are females who try to diagnose people, I think that they get these diagnoses wrong. I think that there's lots of autistic kids who are running around there on ADHD pills who don't have ADHD. There's never anything wrong with them. They didn't want to sit still in class like the little girls did because they wanted to punch little Jimmy over there in the face because he looked at him cross-eyed, and that's a natural male tendency and not something that you're going to be able to just get rid of by figuring out how little Jimmy ticks. Women aren't going to figure out how men tick. Okay, it's not for them.
That's why there are so many women in medicine. It's because there was a feminization of elementary and high school, such that your grades are essentially a measure of your feminineness.
Yeah, and who does well in public school? It's not little boys. It's little girls. And who teaches all the classes? Women. Who's all in the administrative portions of it? Women. Who puts all of the course criteria together? Women. When I went through my kids' school, before we pulled them out and started homeschooling them, okay, I walked through and they had this campaign. It was called the Be Nice campaign. Okay? It's called the Be Nice campaign.
Oh, so no.
This whole campaign. Now, let me tell you about the Be Nice campaign. Okay? It was all about conflict avoidance. When you got down to it, you went through their little bullshit list, right? It was all about conflict avoidance. And I remember looking at my son and saying, you don't avoid conflict. Successful people love conflict. It's the air they breathe. It's the water they swim in. Conflict is something that you should embrace. You should enjoy, right? That's the man's creed. Now, be nice. That's for women, right? But they're teaching it to little boys mm-hmm. like it's for little boys, and it's not. Conflict, little boys love conflict. I don't know how many fights I got in on the playground, but I enjoyed every one of them that I got into. You know, who knows what they were about? That was never the point. It's a rite of passage for men. We beat the hell out of each other for no particularly good reason, and we enjoy it. And I don't think women are going to be able to understand that it's not barbaric and it's not brutal and it's not evil. It's just the way that we're hardwired.
And when the terror of woman installs itself into society and they've successfully neutralized when they successfully have neutralized all these display of aggression, what comes in is actually worse than aggression. It's passive aggressive guerrilla conflict.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's conflict the same thing that happened in the military. You used to have two lines of men shooting, standing up, poof, poof, they shoot each other and that's it. The conflict is resolved. Some side is dead and some side survives. When you go into guerrilla mode and everyone is hiding and it's all secret operations, this is the feminization of war, and we have the feminization of conflict. Ultimately, women look at something like men yelling at each other, and they don't see a pacifying force. They see violence. We have to stop it. What they don't realize is that the very act of a small aggression is actually a pacifying action that prevents further aggression.
And it's how we're wired. You're right. You're absolutely right. Women deal in subterfuge. They deal in subterfuge. They deal in backdoor dealings, things like this. That's contrary to the honor culture that men tend to develop with each other. We have to be able to trust each other. What is a hero? A hero is somebody who was engaged in conflict and came out the other side of something that was horrendous or some type of thing like this, the victor. That's what a hero is. That's what we classify them as, right? You don't give a Medal of Honor to somebody because they did a bunch of subterfuge well. You give them a Medal of Honor because they ran out in the field. They pulled 30 men out of the fight. They got shot three times. They weren't avoiding conflict. So it seems like it's ingrained in our even societal mind that people who don't avoid conflict deserve hero status. And yet the subterfuge of women, what do? They beat it down, beat it down, beat it down. They want men to be Al Bundy. They want men to be Homer Simpson. They want men to be these stupid interchangeable widgets, which we're not. We're just not. And you can't pacify us that way.
All right. Etoile sends a super chat. She says, this later start time is great for those of us who live further west. Okay, well, great. I'm happy that you enjoy the later start time. But I've always been practicing at 7 p.m. Eastern time. Perhaps because when I was young, there was a TV host named Marc Labrèche who had a show every night at 7 p.m. Eastern time, and that remained my model. He says JFG should start at 8 or even 9 p.m. Eastern time. Well, the thing is, there are also other shows that start at these times, and I've always made it a specialty of mine to give an outlook on the day's news at that time. So I stick to 7 p.m. Eastern time. Did you ever speak to Vaush? Vaush is currently trending in the YouTube category on Twitter because he's so much. This guy is always following the regimes, diktats, whether it's about vaccines or mandates. And now he's saying we should starve Russia because and people are pointing to the fact that starving Russia would result in the suffering of the people, citizens. And he says, yeah, but it will be less suffering than the missiles of Russia over East Ukraine. Did you ever speak with Vaush?
Well, I've debated with Vaush, and I recently had him on my program for an interview to try to get a lot of his positions out. I was focused a lot on the pedophilic style of his positions rather than you can only get so much out of a single conversation, especially when it comes to things like geopolitics. The reason that Vaush is always trending, to be completely honest with you, like this is my take on this, take it as you will, but because Destiny and Hassan are always talking about it. I honestly believe that there's a good possibility that Vaush would fade away into obscurity if the mainstream platformers didn't talk about everything fucking Vaush said every day, but they do every day, all day, because they need conflict too. This DGG community, the Destiny community, and the Vaush community, right? They're always going head to head. And if you click on a Destiny program at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, chances are he's bitching about something Vaush is saying. You know what I mean? And then you click on Vosh's channel. He's bitching about something. Destiny's change. They play off of each other, much like news networks do. You'll see this. Fox News breaks a story. Suddenly it's CNN and all the rest of them. It sweeps through. And that's what's trending, right? They all play off of each other. There's no good reason for Vosh to be trending. His takes are not great on most things, but you have to have the villain. Destiny's considered the good guy in the liberal circles, and Vosh is considered the bad guy.
Is that
and
the whole case?
Thing? Yeah, the whole
Isn't
thing
Destiny
is...
Isn't Destiny too libertarian for the liberals at this point, and Vosh's authoritarian approach may be more appealing to these cucks?
It used to be that way, but BreadTube is failing. More people are turning towards conservative media, and this shouldn't shock you, right? More people turn towards conservative media. The BreadTube utopian style thought process of one day we're going to have a stateless society where Worker we're all co-ops. Just singing. Yeah, we're all just singing fucking kumbaya. And we all share some bizarre moral paradigm nobody understands is stupid. And so what ends up happening is the utopian style BreadTube is coming to a halt. Destiny definitely is considered the good guy in most of these conflicts now, and the bad guy trends. Do I think that Vosh has excellent takes? I do not. And I've listened to quite a few of them, but I think that he's good at playing that villain arc. And I consider Twitch fake, just so you know. I think 99% of the shit that happens is fake and orchestrated. I coined a term that Dylan Burns and all of them use now called movers and shakers. I was in a debate with a guy named Wicked Supreme, and I explained to him that in the background of Twitch, there were hundreds of little micro insects. And what they do is they sell influence and they gatekeep and they do this type of shit in order to set up this conflict with this person. And right, the whole thing is a fake fucking setup. And because I put that out in the open, they lost their fucking minds and try to discredit me by saying, because I said movers and shakers multiple times in this debate, right? This has become an actual trending thing on Twitch where this is all they say is, I must be one of those movers and shakers. They try to discredit me this way. But the truth is that they all fucking know that I'm right. And that's exactly what's going on. And most Twitch conflict is fucking set up. It's like WWE. They beat the shit out of each other in the ring. And then they go, what's your wife cooking for dinner tonight, Chuck? Oh, steak. Well, I'm coming there.
Twitch is a weird universe. I've been starting there. I was a streamer on Twitch before I was a streamer on YouTube. And what led to my rise there was Destiny getting engaged with some of my race and science stuff that I was covering. It's a bizarre world of kids and people with Xboxes. It's very weird.
But it's a very influence-based kind of subterfuge-based environment where people are selling influence constantly. They're trying to gauge this person against this person. What's going to make us the most electric content today, guys? Right? What's going to get the most views on this? And this is why I consider 99% of it to be fake. Also, you'll see Destiny will come out with a take and the rest of Twitch will take the entire thing up. And now this is all we're talking about. So there's a hierarchy within this structure. There's gatekeepers within the structure. I don't trust it. I think 90% of it's fucking fake.
All right. We'll be headed toward the conclusion. So BPF, Andrew, thank you so much for coming. By the way, Big Papa Fascist, I know I've asked you about the meaning of that name, and you told me it was kind of a joke to leftists who find you to be a fascist. But do you think that there's something good in fascism? Are you an authoritarian from the state perspective?
I do believe that the state has to have enough authority to enforce morality. I do believe that 100%. I can't think of a point in history where that wasn't the case. And I think that takes confidence of people in the state, though. And I think that the libertarians, the reason that they have massive distrust of the state is because they don't see moral people going in as their leaders. So I've often said, look, if you had moral leaders, would you have problems with your leaders? And the answer from the libertarian is, well, no, because they're moral. The problem we have is
with the view that if you give so much power to the state, look at the current state of morality. Mm-hmm. Essentially, the current state of morality is to be LGBT. It is to favor this kind of lifestyle. So what do you do with the problem of selecting the authority? Well, I would argue that you actually remove authority, and then things like Christianity and the Christians of 200 years ago, there wasn't much of a big state. Their morality was mostly implemented through religious practice and religious networks.
But surely even within your worldview, you understand that there's going to always be some type of hierarchy within humankind. There's just no way to avoid that.
Well, hierarchy, there's a difference between saying hierarchy is a fact of the world and it will exist, and creating an hierarchy where behavior is forced and controlled centrally. I think this is where the problem stems, where central control of behavior is not a good idea. It's much better to have systems like the systems we had 100 or 200 years ago, where a kind of Christian framework for morality stems from the free choice of people and their willingness to join a community and to accept the diktats of that community. If you impose them, the problem is eventually something takes over your structure for imposition, and then you have the LGBT taking over the arm of the state and then using it to all sorts of deeds, including the oppression, for example, of the unvaccinated today.
Well, while I agree with you that you shouldn't have people come to their morality by putting a gun to their head, what I mean by enforcement is things like, look, if my neighbor's jerking off, and we have the non-aggression principle that we, you know, let's say he's in his front yard jerking off, and we're adhering to this NAP, this non-aggression principle that libertarians often postulate, he's not doing anything wrong, technically, you know? And it's like, but I think he is doing something wrong. And I think that there should be some type of enforcement to stop him from doing that wrong thing. I've heard ANCAPs postulate all kinds of things from a private police force and this and that, but it always comes back to some sort of hierarchical structure that exists in order to enforce some kind of general code, general morality, something like this. I think that to stray too far away from that is just straying away from reality into utopian thinking, because there's so few men who are good at solving problems. The ones that are good at solving problems, I believe that most men will naturally gravitate towards them, which is why you have an audience. You have a massive audience because you're good at solving problems, and that's what they think. That's why they gravitate towards you. And don't you gravitate towards men who are good at solving problems yourself? I mean, I most certainly do. And I think that that is going to create a natural state of governance, whether you like it or not.
Well, that is freely converging to a leader. I agree with this. This has to exist. The problem is when you remove that choice of free convergence, then you are imposing a leader. And then the hurtful nature of that leader will be even greater. All right, Andrew, that was really great to hear you tonight. It was great to talk, and I'm sure I'll be on the Crucible again eventually.
I'm sure of it, and it was an honor to be here, JF. This is the one time I don't get to sign off by telling you to shamelessly plug your book, but I think you should anyway.
Well, my book, my audience knows about it, and it is The Revolutionary Phenotype. The link is in the description below. And do you miss blood sports? A lot of people have been answering yes. 9 people answer yes. 2 people answer no. I think we'll never see days like these where the entire internet essentially was centrally converging toward a single debate and everyone was there. We won't ever get this because there's just too much parasitism. Too many people have their YouTube channels now, and it's not a unique thing to be streaming. And so the crowds are more divided, and on top of it, there's censorship. So I don't think the blood sports days will ever come back.
Well, we'll see what happens with Odyssey in the next 3 years, you know.
Absolutely.
If they don't sell out, you got a shot, JF. You got a shot of bringing back those old Worski JF debates like nobody's ever seen before. Well, not with him, but, you know, that style like nobody's ever seen before. You
know? I don't know if I want to go through it again. Much love, everyone, and see you all very soon.